Welcome back to the Moz House Podcast. I'm your host, Hunter B. Gunn. Today I have a special, extra special guest, Denise Silva Dennis, world-renowned artist, also res-renowned. She's also the workshop coordinator at Moz House and has been an artist in residence before. So we're getting a lot of different aspects of her life on this podcast, hopefully. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Hunter. Thank you for having me. I'm going to say in our native language, hello, which is Akwe, and hello to friends out there, Nintampak, and Denise Kwa Wiedemo, Natesawis. That means Denise and Wiedemo are my names. Silva Dennis, Nichapayawunk. That means that's my last name in our language. And Shinnecock Kwa Hassanamisco, Nichashayawunk. Shinnecock and Hassanamisco, that's where I'm from. Those are my nations. And your nations too. And I live on Shinnecock, so that means in our language that would be Shinnecock Natap.
Interesting. I just noticed that you're wearing a Moz House hat. And did you bead that yourself?
I did not bead this myself. I had it beaded though, from one of our cousins through Dahanish. They have Thunderbird Designs, and I believe her sister Nadonis beaded this for me.
Oh, it looks pretty cool. I'm actually a little jealous. I don't have one. I need to get some Moz House merch for myself.
Yes.
I'm surprised it doesn't come with being a staff member. But,
well, maybe next meeting. Yeah, next meeting. Bring that up.
Yeah. So for people who don't know much about your art, how would you describe your art?
I would say that I'm a multidisciplinary artist. I do a lot of paintings. My subjects are a lot of different people. I do historical paintings as well. I love to do pictures of animals. I always love that. But not only do I paint using acrylic and drawing using all kinds of different medium like pastels and watercolor, ink pictures, I also do beadwork. So that's my specialty. And actually, it was Ma's my mother, Loretta Silva, or Loretta Hunter Silva, and she was the first one who taught me how to do beadwork. So that's something that I continue in my practice.
Well, I was going to ask, what is your favorite medium? But is it beadwork?
It probably is. It probably is beadwork.
Okay. This is a question from our fans, aka my mom wants to know this about you.
Okay.
What work are you most proud of throughout your entire career?
That is such a hard question. It's a good question though. I guess it would be the mural at the Shinnecock Community Center that I painted. It was just about 30 years ago. And it outlines the history of our nation, starting with the corn planting mother of the corn, beans, and squash crops. And then it goes all the way through our history with the Shikashin. I know you've brought that up in a previous podcast. And also there's a medicine wheel in there, and it has the names of the people who passed away in that event of the Shikashin. And then it goes through our school. A lot of times our elders here talk about going to the one-room schoolhouse, and because I became a teacher later on, through my own personal history, I guess that would be the most proud accomplishment. And then it goes along with building the playground, the playground that's right next to the community center. There's a new one across the way, but it all kind of goes together, and a lot of people can learn their history, like the children especially can learn their history by looking at the mural. So I think that's probably my most proudest, being able to teach and play at the same time.
It's definitely one of my favorites, for sure. How did you become a teacher? Was that always, I know, did you always want to be an artist, or were you like, you know, I'm going to decide to teach art also? Did you just kind of fall into it?
I had started out a long time ago when I was like in third or fourth grade. And my teacher was Miss Hogan in the Southampton Elementary School, because I went there kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. So I'm a product of the Southampton school district system. And I remember some of us were at the end of the school day, we were taken out and visited the classroom next door, which was a year behind. Maybe I was in fourth grade and they were in third grade. I can't exactly remember the grade levels now. But what they were doing is taking some of the kids out in my class and working with the younger ones. And one of my best friends, a couple of my best friends, kept getting taken out of our classroom to work with the younger ones, like help them with their, get their homework started. And so I was like, well, what are they doing? I want to do that too. I want to, you know, help the younger kids. And then finally, my teacher let me have a chance to do it. And I think that was like my first little taste of teaching to, you know, younger children. And then fast forward years and years later, my brothers had been involved in teaching. You know, my brother David, who's passed on now, he had been a teacher. My brother Peter had been in the teaching and teaching in the school district. Actually, he was a guidance counselor in the same school. So there were all these different, you know, relatives, you know, who were teaching. And then when I was younger, I started teaching on Shinnecock, teaching beadwork through the I think it was through this, maybe Title V or Title IV. I forget the name of it exactly. But I had that time. And also I was doing some teaching after school and after school programs on Shinnecock as a teenager. So I had already started the whole teaching process from very, very young. And then I had been working at New York Telephone for a number of years as a telephone operator in Southampton. And one day, some kids, it was the arrangement came where some kids came over and I was doing a summer school teaching. And I think we brought the kids over to the telephone company and just showing them, you know, this is how it's like a day of work to take your kids to work day and learning about the telephone company right on Windmill Lane in Southampton. And so I kind of transitioned from doing it like a summer program with these kids, which was just a temporary little project, which my cousin Cookie actually had taught me about. They were looking for a summer school teacher. And then she said, hey, you know, in the Southampton School District, there's openings for teacher assistants, and that would be a good way for you to start if you don't want to work at the telephone company anymore. And I really didn't want to. I really wanted to go back to teaching again, since I had been doing that anyway through the years, just unofficially. And so that was my opportunity to go in as a teacher assistant. I ended up with Eileen Lanier, who's a master teacher. And so I learned a lot through her in special education. And then I was doing that for maybe 4 years. And I was already like a natural teacher. It was already just obvious. And some of the people I was working with, like, said, you should just go back and get your master's degree. Why don't you just become a teacher? You're already doing it, so you should. And so then I thought, yeah, I should do that. So then I was going to Dowling College. And my husband Avery, he was taking me to night school. He'd drive me over to the next town and wait for me to take my classes at night school. And by that time, I already had Kelly and Jeremy, my children. So Ma would take care of them at nighttime. And then he would take me over there and maybe visit his grandma, who was over there in Riverhead for a time. And then I would go to my night school. And I did that for about, I think, 4 years, only taking one class or two classes at a time. And was able to get my master's degree. And with that, then you apply to New York State and you get all your certificates, like permanent certification as a teacher. And it just so happened after that, in 2000, jobs opened up in the intermediate school in my district. So I became a resource room teacher and then later became an art teacher and was doing both at the same time. And then finally, I came back to the elementary school again where I had started, and there was an opening for an art teacher. So that's where I kind of retired from there. But I'm still teaching, even though I'm retired from the school district. I still teach at different museums and libraries and after school programs.
You do a lot of teaching still. I know a lot of people's favorites is that something story time.
Oh, yeah, that's called Getting Along Story Time.
Getting Along Story Time, yes. And that was great.
I came out of retirement just in time for the pandemic. in 2020. And I had run into Loretta Davis, who is the executive director of the retreat in East Hampton. It's the only East End domestic violence sexual assault agency. And she said, oh, we're looking for someone, some more people to work in our education department. And I'm like, I'm not really, you know, looking for a job right now. And, you know, there was stories of the pandemic, you know, coming over from Europe, and it was in China. And I'm like, oh, I don't really want to go into schools, because that's where we would have to go, right, you know, during that time. And I'm like, well, maybe something in the fall, you know, maybe something part-time. And they're like, no, we only have full-time, and you should come and just, you know, put in your application. So I did, and I ended up working there, working with Helen Atkinson Barnes and Courtney Hyland, and they really showed me the ropes. I worked there for like, I think it was 13 days, something like that. It wasn't very much. It was probably less than that. And then all of a sudden, we had to go into fully remote. And I had no idea, like, fully remote. So you had to learn how to do Zooms. You had to learn, you know, about podcasts. You had to learn about webinars. And as an art teacher, and having been retired since 2016, I wasn't really using the computer other than the email. So then I just had to learn so much more about technology and how to do, you know, a PowerPoint and all these different things I had no idea how to do. But, you know, I learned. And so they really helped me through the retreat, learning how to do that. And we had to do so many Zooms with different schools and after school programs and teen leaders. And then I was also doing the whole getting along story time, where I would, you know, visit maybe Bridgehampton Recreation Center, their after school program, or the Parish Art Museum. I was doing some different things and at different schools. So now I'm continuing to do that, where I read a story about just children, you know, different ways that they can get along with each other, stories about respect, consideration of others. And then we do an art project afterwards. So I've been visiting so many different places doing that. I just visited the CAST center over in South Hold over the summer. And I will be visiting the Methodist Church. They have in Southampton, they have an after school program, a summer camp. So I'll also be visiting that this summer of 2022.
Sorry, blanking for a second, but so much information to take in. There's a lot. You do a lot of amazing things.
Thank you.
It's hard to keep track of everything. I don't even know how. How do you keep, so what I wanted to ask was, how did you adapt to the whole Zoom thing while being a teacher? Was it like, do you think you were still getting as much work done? Not necessarily getting as much work done, but getting to the kids as much? Was it as helpful, or do you think it really takes away from the whole process?
Well, with Zoom, I had already been retired from the school district. But because I had Courtney, who I was working with at the retreat, she's like a distance specialist anyway. So she was a perfect person to help adapt like the curriculum over whenever we went to visit, you know, whether it was high school kids or middle school kids. And we would team up. So a lot of times, you know, they would show me or direct me or like help me get through, you know, different Zooms, or we'd be together through that. They also would just like have me as like a wing person. So I learned that way, you know, whether it was like keeping track of what was going on in the chat and saying, oh, you know, someone's asking a question, and there's so much going on with Zoom. And of course, you can't really get to the kids as much as you could if you were there. But we would do things like using the smart board. And sometimes I would, it wasn't the smart board, it's a whiteboard on Zoom. So we would do different projects that way, or have them draw things, or everybody would collaborate on something in a way. So we would just do the best that we could. And sometimes we'd go into breakout rooms, you know, for smaller clusters of, you know, visiting with the kids. And just if they felt shy about talking on Zoom, or sometimes they didn't want their faces shown on Zoom after a while, those were just different ways of, you know, reaching them. But it was quite, you know, difficult. And some kids, you know, they were coming back from other areas. So there was this one student who's like, oh, you know, I'm in like a quarantine, And my parents are making me, you know, stay in the room and stay away from them. And he was just feeling so bad. And I just felt like, ugh, I just wanted to reach through, you know, the whole computer and like comfort this, you know, young man, this young student, because he was really feeling down and kind of like rejected. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's going to be okay. And, you know, you'll be out of quarantine soon. And, you know, don't worry, we're here to talk to you, you know, through the retreat. There's so many different options of, you know, people talking beside just visiting, you know, with them and just talking about healthy relationships. You know, he had the option. He could even call into one of the counselors if he wanted to, but it was just a nice connection just to know that, you know, you're not alone. That's sort of the theme that kept coming up through Zoom and with the students that we did work with. You're not alone. We're all in this together, and we just got to make sure everybody's okay.
When I didn't really mind the beginning of COVID, like that quarantine, because I had roommates and it was fine that I didn't get COVID. But then this May, I did get COVID. And that quarantine, we had just moved and I was just stuck in the basement for 2 weeks. Might have been, basically exactly 2 weeks. And my family would just leave food at like the top of the stairs. And then I just like walk up there with a mask, come back down, eat the food by myself. That's when I really felt like quarantine for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was no fun. Definitely felt very lonely. Luckily, some of my other friends, we all kind of got COVID at the same time. So we were in it together, which was nice.
Yeah.
Nice enough. Nicer. Yeah. So we could complain together.
I know with working on Zoom throughout the whole pandemic, I worked out of my house just in a little room upstairs. And in the meantime, Uncle Avery, my husband Avery, he would be down here at Ma's house and he'd be working. So I'd say, okay, I'll see you later. I know you're going to go down there and work at Ma's house, you know, refurbishing everything and reconstructing things. And I'm like, I'm going to East Hampton now, but I wasn't really going to East Hampton. I was in this room all day. And then sometimes at night, if we were doing team leaders at that time, so I felt like I was gone or, you know, somewhere else. Yeah, it was kind of strange.
This is interesting.
Yeah.
You're really there. Your mind's there.
Yeah, your mind is there. But then you're not like walking around, so you're not moving around. You know, one good thing, you know, we're located on the Shinnecock Reservation in Southampton, and where the retreat is out in East Hampton. So that was kind of nice not to have that commute and burning gas and going back and forth or struggling with traffic. So that was one good thing about it.
There's so much less traffic until everyone started moving down here.
Right.
And all the traffic coming back.
Yes.
Twice as bad as before.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about your art. What inspires you to make art? Is there a person? Is it music? It could be anything. I want to know what it is for you.
Well, I felt like I always knew how to do art even before I could actually had any, you know, things like a paintbrush or paints or even had my own drawing paper. In my mind as a little, very young child, I knew that I could do it. So I always feel like I was born an artist. And then what inspired me was like being on Shinnecock and we're surrounded. I don't know how many people, you know, who may be listening, when you think of Southampton, New York, or anything in New York, people always think of, oh, you're right near the city. And we're, you know, an hour or more away from the city, depending on the traffic. And we're way out here on the East End. So on Shinnecock, we're on a peninsula surrounded by water, that's Shinnecock Bay and Heady Creek, and then the ocean's nearby. So any of that landscape or seascape is quite inspirational. And also the different animals that are all around, whether it's raccoons or deer. And then our parents, my dad and my mother, immersed us in our culture. So we always were at powwows, we always had regalia on, and just looking at the my older brothers and sisters and parents and older relatives would be the inspiration, and just being brought up, immersed, whether it's in the Hassanamisco nation up in Grafton, Massachusetts, and going to that powwow every year and being involved with that, or being on Shinnecock and being raised, going to the powwow as just a little baby. I'm the youngest of six, so just being immersed in that, you just kind of automatically are inspired if that's what you're exposed to, you know, and your parents are saying how important it is to be part of that. So that's the important part. And so that's my inspiration. And I love history, and I love drawing and painting our people. And just, you know, even though they've passed on, it's so important, some of the messages that they've given us, to keep it alive. And now it's in different museums, and I can speak on it when I visit different museums or different after school programs or different schools. So it's just important to keep that alive.
Our family has done some pretty amazing things. They're all very inspiring. I feel like I have a lot of good people to look at, and then I can try to incorporate what they're doing to my life. Okay. Sorry. People were just walking above us. I wasn't sure they're coming down here or not.
Well, Ma, your grandmother, would always say that she bathed us all in brilliantine.
Brilliantine?
That was whenever anybody did something exceptional. Exceptional. Then I bathed them in brilliantine. That's why.
I mean, no wonder. No wonder everyone around here is so incredible. What did you envision for Jeremy and Kelly when they were younger? Did you have anything that you were like, I think they're going to be this?
I didn't really know what they would become, but I knew what they would not become. You know, I knew that they, whatever they'd become, it'd be something, you know, to serve the community, to be positive, good people, to help others. Because we just also immerse them in all kinds of different things, activities, taking them everywhere, doing different things with them, whether they were in even like Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, going to powwows, and just again, immersing them in whatever I was taught, just sharing that with them. But what they've become is more than I could ever imagine. It's like, oh, it's way over my head. It's like, oh, I can't believe they did this and did that and were able to achieve different things. But I'd always look for, like, what's the best school when they were little? Like, what's the best school that they could go to in Southampton? So they both went to Our Lady of the Hamptons at different points and different periods of time. And then what's the best school after that? And then the Ross School was the best school after that. And even before that, like, where's the best little preschool? And at Southampton College, they had a little preschool. And that's where Kelly went. And then Jeremy went to a little OLH school. So anything that, you know, started them off in a positive way, where I knew that the teaching there would be very beneficial for them, and they would not be put into they're just Shinnecock kids. Like, I did not want that, because I felt like in the, you know, school, even though I worked for the Southampton School District, I knew that in the past it would be, oh, they're all Shinnecock. So then you put in a certain category, and maybe expectations of what you would become were not what they should have been. Like with my sister, when she's a little older than me, when she graduated from high school, she was, you know, very, you know, really intelligent, scored well on all these different testings, and she wanted to be in AP classes. And sometimes, you know, the teachers would be like, oh, no, you would not really fit in this class. So she had to kind of fight for everything that she was able to achieve. And one of the things that she wanted to do was to go to Dartmouth College. And it so happened that her guidance counselor at the time actually graduated from Dartmouth back in, I don't know, the 40s or something like that, or the 50s. And we're talking about her in 1975. And she said, oh, I want to, you know, that's where I want to go. There's a Native American program there. And I've done research on it. And it was actually developed to educate Native American students back when it was first founded. And that would include people from Hassanamisco, our reservation up in Massachusetts, as well as the Long Island people going back in time. And he was like, oh, no, you don't want to do that. You can really do well in the industry of housekeeping because there's so many mansions here. There's so many rich people who come, you know, people with lots of money. And you do well, you know, being a servant.
Ouch.
Mm. And she's like, no. Yeah. No, I think she even got an application from one of her friends who was also applying. And it seems like he had an extra application for Dartmouth or for some kind of scholarship. And anyway, she ended up winning this scholarship. Like only four kids on Long Island won, went to Washington, D.C. And she did go to Dartmouth. She was accepted there. So your Aunt Darlene.
What did that guy's counselor know? Nothing.
No. But by the I had the same one. And then by the time I came along, he was very helpful in getting me into Hamilton College. So
he realized somewhat of the error of his ways.
Yes, I think he did. I think he learned his lesson dealing with the Silvas.
That's weird that everyone has guidance counselors issues. I mean, me and your sister both did. My guidance counselor, although I did drop out of college, my guidance counselor was like, oh, you should probably just go to community college. Although my grades were not bad and I tested well, they're like, you'll do better there. But maybe I would have done better there, honestly, since I did drop out. But I had no idea what I could actually get into at the time.
Right.
So I didn't apply to like many places. Like, well, this is my reach school, I guess. And I got into any school I applied to. So then looking back, I was like, I wonder where I really could have gone in if I don't think I'd get into Harvard. But hey, you never know. It's possible.
You never know. You don't know because there's different schools have, you know, different outreach programs and they have different, you know, help. And they know that, you know, that's part of their whole mission statement when they were founded was to educate Native Americans. And some of that's still in place. And that's things that a lot of different counselors, they just don't realize that. It's like Shinnecock. When I say Shinnecock Nation or Hassanamisco Nation, that is like we're a whole separate country within a country. Mm-hmm. And that what goes along with that are special incentives and special ways that we're supposed to communicate with each other, whether it's different treaties or, you know, through the government. It's just a special association. And a lot of people don't know, you know, about that.
They don't.
So you have to be, somebody has to be, you have to be your own advocate or somebody has to advocate for you, you know, somehow. Mm-hmm. And it happens from time to time.
I was going to bring up advocating. We have to do a lot of self-advocating as Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That most other, especially when you're younger, most other kids do not have to learn to self-advocate. Most of my friends nowadays are just learning to be good self-advocates. Like, it's kind of just like the art of talking about yourself and being, like saying the truth about yourself, not like, I guess it's almost like hyping yourself up, but it's like the truth about you, not letting people have their thoughts about what you are before, and then you like, I guess, tell them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I know, they do not think as highly of themselves as they should, I feel like. So they're willing to accept less pay for something, especially most of my friends who do, who are artists, they're like, oh, I can only charge $100 for this. When I'd be like, you could charge $500 for that. In my head, that's how much it's worth. But in their head, for some reason, it's only worth $100. And they don't know how to get from the 100 asking for 100 to 500. And then they'll feel bad for asking for how much they're worth. Mm-hmm. So we had to self-advocate from a young age. So it kind of helped a lot. But it would have been good to teach more the general. They had to, I don't know if it's good, but more people need to be able to self-advocate, I feel like. And we just kind of have always had to self-advocate, so
mm-hmm.
it's helped out us now. Looking back, it's helped out having to self-advocate so much, but a lot of people missed out on the opportunity of having to self-advocate.
Yeah. No. I mean, a lot of people probably, there is no need for them to really have to do that, be an advocate for themselves. Because so much of the system has been developed for them just to go through, or maybe their parents or grandparents or their neighbors, you know, oh, we have this program. So they're invited to, you know, pursue different opportunities. And a lot of times, you know, what's the opportunity? What was the opportunity when my sister graduated in 75? So you're going to advocate as a counselor to become, you know, a maid. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just like there's so much more that don't you see that there's so much more? Or that could be like a feather in your head if you in a hat if you, you know, stood behind this person and said, okay, well, I'm gonna, you know, really recommend you and push you toward this, and you know, if you need any help, you know, I'm an alumnus of this college. So it's just, you know, it's sad things that have happened in the past.
Very unfortunate. It's very crazy to me that that guidance counselor was a graduate of the school she wanted to go to and then did not put in a good word. I'm never going to forgive that guidance counselor.
And then the other thing is that it was also at that time, I think it was all male only school, Dartmouth.
Really?
And Hamilton, where I went, you know, a few years later, that was also all male. And the year I went there, they transitioned to include male and female. The other part of the campus was called Kirkland. And interesting enough, both of those colleges were first developed as academies for Native American students, and mostly in the Northeast, because the frontier was moving, you know, further west. Like Pennsylvania was a frontier at the time, that area. Upstate New York, parts of that was, oh, that's a frontier. That's a wilderness still. So we're talking about going back in like to the late 1600s, that period of time, 1700s. But it's also important to know your history. If you don't educate yourself and know your history and know about your people and just kind of delve into it, it's not going to be written in any books. So you have to go and you have to do your own research. In order to be an advocate, you have to, you know, have information. So it's cool that now there's so much information available through the internet and people sharing with each other. So the true stories of what really happened. And like every day it seems like I'm finding out something, a new story about something.
Yeah. And half the time it's about, you know, modern day, half the time the stories are about Jeremy or Kelly or somebody around here, someone I know. It's actually insane how often.
In the media?
Yeah. How often either social media or in old media, which is just newspapers they're in. It's amazing. So I want to move a little bit more back to the art side of things. So I came up with some specialized questions for you, since we can't ask you, like, how did you discover Moss House? And, I mean, technically, maybe in some ways you did make Moss House yourself somehow, because since you made Jeremy. But so for anyone who might want to become an artist, what is an important personality trait for an artist?
I think like dedicating your time to your art is important. And like throughout my career as a teacher, I had put down my art for a long time because I'd just be too exhausted either teaching it or prepping for, you know, other people's projects, you know, for the next day or a couple of days in advance. So it's just important to dedicate your time for your own art, and just keep it going whenever you can, even if you have to say, okay, well, I'm not going to work on this other part. I know this thing is due, you know, to get these things together. I have to at least do a little painting, or I have to do a little beadwork, or whatever you do, whether it's ceramics or maybe, you know, fire, glass, whatever it is, it's just important to always, you know, keep a finger on that and don't let it go for too long, because I feel like you start kind of, your spirit kind of dies if you don't follow your art. And that's really a, you know, it's given by the creator, and it's like a special thing about you. And I know another thing is, you know, trying to get away from it, like, oh, well, I know how to do art, but I want to do other things. And it's just important to really protect and nurture that special gift that you've been given, and to share it with others. whether it's sharing, that would be a personality trait, whether it's sharing opportunities, like maybe there's something that, you know, I don't really know how to do. I don't know clay that well. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with it. But it's important to like, okay, well, I know somebody else who I'm going to connect these people because I know that they would have a good opportunity to, you know, do this. Or I don't know about, you know, photography. Jeremy knows about it. So even though he's my son, but, you know, someone else like that, you know, they're interested. So I think that that's also important to share what you know and what you have. Because if you don't share it, then people aren't going to know about you. I have a friend who they don't want to share a lot of things publicly because they're said, you know, somebody's going to steal my idea. And that's true. I mean, it has happened to this one person, but how is anybody going to ever know about you if you're not out there talking about it or sharing at least some portion of it?
Yeah. It's almost a selfish thing to do with your art, I would say. Because I don't know if people who just straight up steal your ideas, you can always track that back.
Mm-hmm.
But if I somehow love their idea and was like, this inspired me to build upon their idea,
mm-hmm.
would that really be that bad of a situation for them? Maybe.
I know when I was teaching, whenever anybody's idea, I don't even know, it was probably a faculty meeting, we were talking about ideas and this person took my idea. And then whoever was the presenter, I think someone was presenting to the faculty, they said, well, that's the greatest form of, you know, admiration when somebody thinks your idea is great.
Yeah.
So you could,
at least if they can't come up with a better idea themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's actually just straight up stealing your idea, then just know you already won. Mm-hmm. You're just going to have to
mm-hmm.
find a way to not really get back at them, but
mm-hmm.
make it known that the person should at least give you credit.
Right.
Like if I were to borrow your idea and be like, this is this person's technique and I've turned it into this.
Mm-hmm.
And now in my head, it's better since now we kind of collaborated together. Without your work, I wouldn't have been able to do mine.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how that would work for me.
Yeah.
If someone took one of my ideas.
Right. Right. I was working with this group in Patchogue called the Peace Group from the Patchogue Arts. And so we were talking about how a lot of people don't think that they're creative.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know. You have to try different things. So I think that's another part of the creative process. Everybody has some kind of creativity. And it might be writing, it might be singing, it might be doing beadwork, it might be painting. But there's just so many different ways. Creative people aren't just the people that you see as a painter. There's so much more. Like I had one girlfriend growing up and she could hardly write her name. Her handwriting was so horrendous.
Oh, just like me.
I think it stayed that way. And she was like, oh, I wish I could draw. I wish we were little kids. I wish I could do beadwork. And it's like, but those are all things that I was gifted with. You're probably never going to be able to do that. But then later on, she picked up a piece of clay and was like, you know, putting all these things on a wheel and making all these, you know, beautiful pots. So you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of the creative person. To just try all kinds of different things in all kinds of different mediums,
mm-hmm.
And see, you know, where you can express yourself, because there's always a place for you to express something.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of finding what kind of art you can do comes with just being alive for longer. The longer you are around, the more things you can try, figures out what works for you. I know I'm not going to be I'm not a very good drawer, cannot draw. I like doodling, though, and some people say those are good, but I cannot transfer that into, like, a big piece of whatever. I cannot really create wonderful things with my hands, usually, but with a computer, I can do a lot of cool things. With using technology in art is what works for me, so what I usually do.
We have a lot of fun on Sundays when we do the project here with the art.
I love trying all the art forms because that kind of brings me into like my hyper focus mode because it's something that's nice. Like I really like that type of art. I'm just not proficient at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think how good I could be at, if I got to my best at drawing, it would be a lot lower than my best at videography. So I don't. So I just do that drawing for fun, and mm-hmm. it's always been interesting learning the techniques because I like educating myself on all the different art forms. But I know deep down that I will never be as good as you at that type of stuff, mm-hmm. at least.
But you might be. You never know. You might be
pretty good.
Yeah, you might be great at abstract art, and mm-hmm. I might not be so great.
I do like making shapes, and I mean, even in my notebook, there's. It's like random,
mm-hmm.
random like lines and stuff, yeah. which looking like, I do like shapes. I don't know. I do really like drawing and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It just does not look good. Same with my handwriting. Even the teachers knew something was wrong with my handwriting for a long time. There's nothing they could do about it. There's nothing. So what was your first job? So this is another question of my specialized questions for you.
Hmm. My first official job where I was getting a paycheck was probably on the reservation during the summer program where we just would do different projects on the res. One of the things that I did, it ended up being for the summer program, was we used to have this a teepee, and it was made out of like cement. It was a permanent teepee down at the powwow grounds. And it had been there for a long time because our powwow is almost like it's close to being like an 80-year-old powwow. And so there was this permanent ceramic teepee and the paint had pretty much come off of it. So I designed, you know, some paintings on it, and it was right at the entrance. So I was lucky to connect again with the art and have that in my background. And like everybody else had to help get the powwow grounds all set up, whether it was mowing grass or like putting out the fence or, I don't know, doing all kinds of other things, getting like maybe the first aid section all dusted out or cleaned out, because we don't really only use the powwow grounds once a year as a fundraiser for the res. So I think that was probably one of my first jobs that were official with a paycheck. But most of the time what we would do is like clean up the roads if there was garbage on the roads and just doing different manual labor and, you know, going down to the beach and cleaning that up in the summer. Maybe painting things other than artistic things, like maybe painting a wall in the community center or something like that. So, or we'd have lunch also. I know that. And so maybe it would be like working in the kitchen, handing out the lunches and doing different things like that.
So, well, very cool. Speaking of powwow, you're having a booth this year, right?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yes. Please come check out Antonisa's booth. I will probably be there also.
Yes.
If not, handing out chili in my my home base. I am filming some parts of powwow this year for my own little project. We'll see what that turns into. Not really sure yet.
Yes, I am.
Is that cool?
Yep, I'm preparing things for the powwow now. One of the things that I designed this year, which I've never done in the past where I designed it myself, was I'm taking one of my paintings. It's called Land Back Butter. And it was featured on Native American Calling. They actually called me up when it was at Jeremy's curatorial debut at the Southampton Art Center. It was one of two paintings, and so the woman from Native American Calling wanted to know, among other things, about that Land Back Butter painting that I did. So I'm making that into t-shirts and also tote bags, and those will be on sale at the powwow. And it kind of goes along, you know, I said I'm multidisciplinary as an artist, but I'm also an activist artist as well. I've designed for different projects like the Graves Protection Warrior Society, which I'm a board member of, or the Nyamuk Land Trust, where sometimes we're doing different protests about land that's being taken away. And so our burial grounds nearby the reservation. And so I do different logos, whether they end up being logos for t-shirts, or they might be like also handbags, canvas bags, just to get it out there to let the public know, you know, much of our land has been taken away here on Shinnecock. We originally had 3,600 acres, and that's all in dispute in Shinnecock Hills. So that's what that Land Back Butter painting is about. It's kind of based on the Land O'Lakes butter. That's why it's called butter. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, the Native American woman was taken off, and now it just says farmer owned, even though it's my most favorite butter. I still love it. But I'm like, what happened to the Native American? So I put her back in on that butter display.
In my prediction for that shirt, it will probably be a bestseller, at least for this powwow, just how the chili was the bestseller last year.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll wear it around too. I'll advertise, you know, that type of stuff.
All right. Well, what size is your t-shirt?
I'll go with an XL probably.
XL. Okay.
Yeah. XL. And then I could just be decked like you had a tote bag too. Walking around, put my camera in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, we'll figure that out later. So we are getting up here in time. So okay. I'm going to try to get through these last few questions for everybody, and then they'll have a chance to endorse anything you want to endorse at the end. Okay, so this question I've been asking all of the everyone in the alumni circuit. I guess technically you are also part of the alumni circuit.
Yes, I am.
So, I'd also like to talk about your residency. So we'll see how long this takes.
Okay.
Do you believe in spirits/ghosts? And if you do, could you share a paranormal experience with us?
Well, the light just turned off. It's been turning on and off the whole time. Yes, I do. I believe in spirits. I'm trying to think of a good story. There's so many good ones of things that happened. I'll just say, like, when your grandmother passed away here, that was like a very huge spiritual thing that happened here. And so, like, when she passed, before she passed, I thought she had already passed away, but she hadn't, because she was up at Stony Brook. So it was like different strange things were happening in the house. Like lights were like going on and off, that type of thing, you know, happened after she passed away, and just different things over the telephone, like other people's conversations. It was just like weird stuff that was going on electronically that were like did not happen before and has not happened like that since.
You guys were hearing other people's conversations on the phone?
Yeah, it was like I was anyway. I heard this conversation. It was like between a telephone operator and this man, and it was like cross circuits on the telephone, and it was an actual conversation that was going on that we heard, and it was like, and it didn't happen really before that, and it didn't have to happen after that. And they say like that's part of a spirit's energy, is to go through the electricity of a house, and with that dimming of the room, and you know, going back and forth, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's lots of things. Sometimes, like when we moved into our other house, because we were staying here, Ma's house, and trying to rebuild and improve and add on to the other house up the road. Sometimes just going into the house, it seemed like you almost hear like people talking, like having a whole conversation, but you can't really make out what they're saying. But it's just like there's a presence in there. I don't really see that or hear that much anymore. It was just like when we were first going there. And then just sometimes, like when I'm in that house up the road, it's like the way the sun will come in a certain way and then just light up the room. And I've never, like this one day, it was like a golden hour. And like, it just feels like the spirits are there. And a lot of the work that I, as I mentioned with the Graves Protection Warrior Society, we do have to go to places like New York City at the American Museum of Natural History or different museums throughout Long Island, and we get our we have to get our Native American like people back. Like there's bones and there's skulls that were collected all over the place that were dug up in Shinnecock Hills and all over Long Island and put into museums and put on display. So we have to go and get them. So during that time, we know that there's a spiritual connection. So we have to have a whole ceremony for them and ask for forgiveness. So, I mean, I've never, during those times, I've just seen some little things like in preparation. One time we were doing some, really early in the morning, it was like full moon, we do things. And then at dawn, and even if it's like the cold of winter, that's when we prepare the different bones that come back and have ceremony during that time. And someone's earring had fallen off as we were preparing a box to put our relatives away so we could rebury them. And someone's earring had fallen in, and it's like, I'll leave that because that's what they wanted. Somebody wanted that earring. So many times when we do get the what they were buried with, some of these museums will also give us those ceremonial objects, whether they're like turtle shells or sometimes they're clam shells. And they're very, very old. They're ancient. But we also offer wampum that's been modern made, or shells or tobacco. We give them certain things. So that's just kind of part of the whole ceremony that we do.
Very interesting.
So I guess you would have to believe in the spirits in order to participate in all that. And not that I've really seen anything, but there's just like a feeling that you get after doing that and prayers that you do. And good things have happened, like good things that have happened to me. Since I've been doing that, that's not even related to, you know, burying them, just different opportunities. So I feel like, well, maybe that's just on the spirit world of them saying, oh, thank you for the work that you're doing to put our souls at rest and getting them out of museums or getting them out of sheds somewhere that somebody just stuffed them in a shed somewhere and they're forgotten people. So I just feel like that is the acknowledgement. And the light turned off again.
Yeah. That's funny. It started happening right when we started talking about and right as we ended.
Yes.
Oh, my God. And now it's even brighter than before, it feels like.
Right.
Little. Well, that's interesting. Another, as you said, acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess we had our first somewhat. I mean, someone could see that as a slightly paranormal experience
right
there.
Yeah, good.
Spirit saying thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. They know what you do. So I have three more questions I want to get through. So this one, this is one personal question kind of, but personal for me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you imagine the world in 50 years?
Boy, that's a hard one.
I guess, do you think the world's going to be like absolutely destroyed and we'll be the last civilization left in our own little area? Or do you see us getting past all these issues facing modern day right now, like climate change and the sea level rising?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I'm like, it doesn't seem like Shinnecock will still be here with the sea level rising by then. Because everything is melting so fast, the icebergs and all that. I hope that with technology that something can be done and people realizing that there really is a problem. Like right now, there's droughts.
Yeah.
And there's been... and. Part of that is because dams were built back in the 50s, you know, throughout the United States. And so it took away the natural ways that the Creator, you know, made places. And I hope through technology that there's a way, okay, if the sea is rising, then convert some of that water to these places that are dry. Instead of oil pipelines, get some water pipelines in and divert that water to where it needs to go. So I'm hoping, but I don't know. It depends on the people who are really interested and who have all the power and the money and the technology, if they will become woke enough, because they seem to be the people that control everything. Mm-hmm. You know, or you can't, like they say, you can't eat oil, you can't eat money. And right now, it doesn't even have to be 50 years, they're saying that, you know, with food, it's a problem where the crops are just drying up. They can't, there's such droughts in different places. And if it's not droughts, and it's, you know, all this flooding where the water is just like going crazy. So, yeah, I don't know. You can only really pray what it will be, hopefully, like, in 50 years. I mean, in my time, you know, when I was a baby, that's when nuclear power, you know, and just, like, bombing, you know, and the clouds, the mushroom clouds, you know, were, like, happening, like, maybe just before I was born in the 60s, where it was all, like, let's destroy everything. So hopefully, you know, there will be, especially in our country here on the United States of America, people asking for gun control because they're just killing each other, you know, randomly, mm-hmm. you know, no reason, and more crazy reasons. So I don't know. I guess a lot of prayers is what's needed out there, you know, for hope for the future.
Yeah. I am excited for the future and kind of probably only got like 30 years really do stuff before really bad things are happening. If we don't change the current trajectory of our path of the world, is no good. My generation's going to have to. My generation, my sister's Jen.
Everyone's
being born now. Little Benji. We're all the ones that, especially Benji's Jen.
Yeah,
the ones they're really gonna have to deal with.
Yeah, and he was only born yeah, in March of 22,
so like 3 months ago. And he's our only hope.
Little Benjamin, Tila's son, my great nephew. Was he? Yeah, he's a great nephew. Yep, and you're a great nephew too.
Okay, so this is my last question to you. Oh. God, I guess I have two things I really want to touch upon. Okay. Last question for you then. Is there something that you wish I had asked you about?
No, I think he pretty much covered everything. I'm glad you asked about powwow because that's coming right up. But really, I'm thinking about going, sometimes when I'm thinking about or doing an interview or doing a presentation, and I'm like, oh, I wish I had said this, or I wish I had said that. But just to reiterate, what we always try to say is how, you know, through the indigenous way is to plan for the next 7 generations. If you're not thinking about people who are going to be like, talking about little Benjamin, who's only a few months old, but think about his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and so on and so forth. And so if more people around the world could think, don't think of just, you know, now, don't think of just in 50 years, think about generations, which is hundreds and hundreds of years, and stop dedicating so much time to try to go to Mars or go wherever you're trying to go, and really take care of this planet, because this is our mother, our, you know, and so we should be taking care of her as she has tried to take care of us. So I guess that's about the only thing to just add on. I'm glad to see, you know, that Ma's house is here, and you know, I guess I would say, like, in 50 years, just starting it just, like, locally, that I hope that the water, you know, doesn't come up so much. And if it does, I hope that by that 50 years that we get our Shinnecock Hills back, so that
That'd
we
be
at
nice.
least we have a higher elevation of living. And so that's what I would like to see that would happen. I mean, the things that have been happening that have been positive for Shinnecock have really been happening to reclaim. You know, we just got Sugarloaf back, and that was our most important burial ground in Shinnecock Hills. So I hope that trajectory continues. And here in Southampton, where, you know, they're just digging up things just to make second homes for people, you know, these gigantic houses. You don't need a gigantic, humongous house. I mean, we're surrounded by these mansions everywhere. And do you really need that? Do you really?
No.
Does, you know, why?
No.
Really? Why?
Maybe two extra rooms. You can have some
Yeah.
friends over.
Yeah,
Have some
like
friends
maybe
stay overnight.
Like a crafts room or an art
Yeah,
room
an
or
office.
something.
I mean, I understand the want for space, but at some point it becomes too much. Like having a house when you live by yourself, that can even that can be too much. Like even having a 3-bedroom place when you live by yourself, that's a lot of space you have to figure out stuff to do with. You're not going to spend all your time. You're only going to use like 2 or 3 rooms. Maybe like your workspace, your hangout, and then your bedroom. And anything after that, now you have to like think about, oh, I want to use this room now. I never get to use it. I might as well use it now. At that point, I think you have a little too much space, and there could be like three families living in there if they split the cost of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, just look at just, I don't see, you know, with the people who have so much in this area, like how can you not really look around you and
Yeah.
see like there's so much homelessness and so much suffering right here? Like we're in a third world, you know, and so much in this area. And then just across the water, it's like ridiculousness with people landing their helicopters or just building these it's just not even just like a normal regular house with, you know, 3 bedrooms. It's like 15 bedrooms and, you know, 20 bathrooms, and then you're polluting the water, you know, on top of it, and just adding nitrogen. And it's not that much land. Long Island is just so big. It's just so wide. It's more long than it is wide. You know, it's 100 miles long, but it's not that many miles wide.
These people are under some sort of delusion. And when they and then they look around, I think they see something. They don't see anything. I think it's what it is. It's like their brain just blocks it out, or they just block it out themselves on purpose. I think it's intentional in a way.
But there are some allies.
Mm-hmm,
there are
definitely
good
are.
There are good people out there too, who take notice. So there's always hope.
There is always
there's
hope.
Always hope
there's
for
always
others,
hope.
And we do have a lot of allies who have been helping us along the way, and I'm grateful to them, and I hope there's more. I hope that word spreads. I guess that would be for the next 50 years, that I hope that more people realize this is really what's going on, and what can you do for your legacy. That's one thing that I did learn when I worked at the elementary school. It was through this leadership training, and what will your legacy be? You're sitting at a table, you're 80 years old. What have you done to help others? What, you know, what makes others remember you for good things? And I just know that I'm 60, I'll be 62 this year, and I see some elders around this community, and I think that older than I am, and they're kind of trying to figure out, how can I improve my legacy now? Or they're saying things, all these positive things about themselves. Or they're saying, oh, back in my time, it wasn't like that. But I'm like, I saw you back in some of those times that you're talking about in my 60 years. And you're trying to rewrite history. Why have to try to rewrite history? Do the right thing, you know?
Well,
you know,
it's a good thing to think about. I think one of my legacies would definitely be some, made a lot of people laugh, which is nice. Good, some nice joy. And then we'll see what else I do in the next 60 years. That's a long time for me. Until I'm 80. Who knows what I will do in the next 60 years? Maybe I'll. Hopefully. I plan on doing some good things, but we'll see. Who knows? Who knows what we'll have time for?
When I think of you and you doing podcasts and just recording everyone here at Ma's house, you inherited that through your grandfather, Skip.
Really?
Yes, because he would always be taking movies of everybody. If there's old pictures, you won't see him because he's the one who's taken all the pictures. He's hardly ever in any of the old pictures or the old films. But and then he would have us over and would have a movie night. Your grandparents.
Sounds cool. Would they be family movies or would they?
They'd be family movies and it'd be fun to watch. And I'm like, oh, Hunter, it's like really continuing that legacy of his grandfather.
One thing I definitely want to do, you mentioned how he was not in the pictures very often or the videos. I want to also have myself, so people know when they see the videos, they're like, oh, that's the guy who is also behind the camera. Look, I don't have to be in there for very long.
Right.
Just like a few frames, but at least people say, oh yeah, I'm the cameraman. Turn it around to myself, be like, I filmed this, turn right. it back to everyone else.
Right. And you can do that these days with that kind of very technology.
Easily. Very easily. Okay, so I guess we'll move on to our last and final question, and then I'll give you some time to just give everyone your website, your social media, how anyone can contact you, check out your art, check out any of the services you're providing. Last question is, do you have any questions for me?
How many more podcasts do you have that you have to do from here on about?
Well, for the alumni circuit, I think I have 2-3 signed up already for the rest of this week. And then the current artist in residence. And then I think we have 3 alumni artists who have not reached out yet. So I'm going to re-email them, send them a new link. Although it is getting close to Powwow, if they can't get in before the end of August, we're going to have to schedule it for the weeks coming after Powwow. But luckily, we have content now for like 2 or 3 months, it feels like, because once the 13 alumni artists are done, and then we still have artists in residence, so we're going to have to, every time there's new artists in residence, we're going to insert them into that schedule. So I'd say like 4 or 5 left.
So you're busy.
It's been a lot in the past 2 weeks. I feel like I haven't talked this much in years.
Oh. But, yeah,
if humans ran out of the amount of words they could say, I'd be out. Just from this past week. But it's been fun.
Right. What's the most surprising thing that you've learned during doing your podcast?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm going to give you a hard one like you gave me hard ones.
I've learned that a lot of people are born artists, I guess. That's very interesting. A lot of people knew from a young age that they wanted to be creative or were good at it. There's one other thing that I always thought was very interesting. The artist in residence, when they're here, everything's focused about their art. And then when I have on the podcast, you really get to understand them in ways that I wouldn't have before, because now I have like my own personal conversation with them that we get to share. And everyone always has these very, how they got to where they are now is always so different from every other artist. And it's like there's no one path to becoming an artist. Everyone's path is very different, but it somehow all led them to Ma's house, which I think is pretty amazing.
Well, I didn't really expect to be a resident at Ma's house. So I was happily surprised when I was invited. And then Brianna did the curation of it. So that was great. I think it was actually your mom. Several years ago, she said, Aunt Denise, you need to collect all your artwork and have your own show. And I'm like, oh yeah, that would be so great. I think we were visiting one of Jeremy's shows in Southampton at one of the galleries. And so I said, yeah, I should do that. And then as Ma's house on more people were coming in, whether it was the residents themselves. They'd see some of my paintings hanging around here and there, and like, oh, you should put that out, and you should, you know, who did that one? Did you do that one, Jeremy? And he's like, no, my mom did. And so it's been great in 2022 for me, because the residency of, you know, asking your mom and asking different family members to borrow back the different art that's all over everybody's house, or their beadwork or their regalia that I had made for them, or photographs of us all together at old powwows. It's helped me to have a really great 2022, because not only was my art here, but so many people got to see it, whether it was people from all different organizations that were already interested in Jeremy's work, whether it's a Parish Art Museum, they all came, where Brianna works there in the special series that she works in, or friends of Jeremy, who he's done work with before, have come. So then that gave me the opportunity also. I was included in the outcropping, which Jeremy curated. So that gave more exposure, and it was like on News 12. You know, they had come out, and Doug Geed had come out and interviewed for that. And we were on showcased on their special East End stories. So many places. Long Island Traditions, I've had worked with them in the past. But it's just so much more exposure. And then at the African American Museum in Southampton, I had a piece there for the BIPOC project that Jeremy also curated. And then now I'm still at the Long Island Children's Museum, and also at the Long Island Museums in Stony Brook. I have a painting there as well, and several paintings at the Long Island Children's Museum, along with Jeremy and Tahanish and David Martin and myself, and we did workshops there. And that's ending in August or September, actually. I think you can still see that show until September. So there's a few other projects and art shows that I'm in. So it's been really an exciting year after teaching art all that time, or doing the Getting Along story time. It's like I actually have my art out there for more people to see and to learn about. Or, you know, whether I've done my own Zooms with different museums or libraries and talking about art, and or just talking about what I've been talking about as an activist. I'm sharing the history of Shinnecock. So it's kind of all fallen in together. And sometimes my art is protest art, so I'm busy doing posters, you know, but they're artistically done about getting land back. So it just all seems to feed off of each other and coexist together.
One thing I noticed about when you were getting all your art back, how much art I've been seeing my entire life was just gone all of a sudden. And I realized, I was like, there's no way Anthony's made everything I've been seeing for the past 24 years. Where is this? Where to go? Like, where's this? Oh, it's Anthony's show. Oh, what happened to your regalia? Oh, Anthony's made that too. Where's this? Anthony's is showing it right now. Yeah. Just had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, your mom's regalia is at Penn State right now.
Yeah, insane.
That'll be there till November if anybody is in the Penn State area, State College. There's a little show with the regalia that I beaded. That your grandmother actually helped me cut out that regalia.
Oh, really?
Be Patty, we used to call her.
Mm-hmm. Be Patty.
Be Patty.
In my phone, her house number is still saved as Be Patty's. So, what was I about to say? Okay, well, I guess this is the end of the podcast. But before we go, thank you for being on. And if you have a chance now to plug in your social media, tell people to check out your website, endorse whatever you want to endorse. This is your time to just say what you need to say, endorse what you want to endorse.
Okay. Well, you can just find me at Denise Silva Dennis. Just put that in and it will come up. That will be my place to find me. And that's Silva, S-I-L-V-A, Dennis, just put it all together. You should be able to find me on social media that way, or weetamoe@gmail.com. It's W-E-E-T-A-H-M-O-E. That's my Native American name. And please come to the powwow. That's going to be September 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022, Labor Day weekend. And we have not been able to have the Shinnecock Powwow open to the public for 2 years. So it's really great after this whole COVID pandemic. It's still out there, but at least we're at a spot where we can still have our powwow finally. So I hope everybody comes there, and I hope you visit, you know, where I have my artwork, and there'll be some chili there, as Hunter was saying. He'll probably help to sell that chili and cornbread, and just come and have a nice time and see the dancing and the singing and everybody coming together, because we really, really missed having all the public there. And it will be a great time. We missed a lot of our, you know, neighboring people from other nations, seeing them. A lot of people have passed on. A lot of people have got COVID. Some people didn't make it through COVID. So, you know, we're thinking about them too, the people who passed on during these last couple of years. All right. So that's that. Some people were born during COVID.
A lot of people were born.
So we have things to be thankful for. For also
Benji's first powwow.
Yes, a little Benjamin.
Speaking of powwow, the whole Mom's House crew will be there at some point. Everyone will be there at different times, so it'll be a chance to meet everyone, have a meet and greet, although I doubt anyone's really looking to meet me. But Jeremy, Denise, Brianna, they will be there, or Denise Silva Dennis, sorry, I'm just so used to calling you Anthony's. All the greats will be there, and I will be there as well, doing some work. But feel free to say hello. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This is our longest episode ever, but well-deserved, the longest episode ever. We had a lot to talk about. You have lots of interesting things to say. It was great. All right, that was this episode of the Mouse House Podcast. We'll see you guys next time.